Hello and welcome to The Calling. This is the Reverend Marek Sobrisky, and my co-host Andrew Boyer is with me, and we're privileged today to have a chance to speak with Cheryl Kyle, Kieran Royce, and Debbie Smith. In the relationship between Christ Church and Tanzania and the Diocese of Mount Kilimanjaro, and a school now that's been in operations for 15 years that's educating over 750 students. It's truly a story of a miracle. So I'd like to begin by asking Cheryl and Kieran to tell us a little bit about how Christ Church started to get involved with Tanzania and the Diocese of Mount Kilimanjaro on the other side of the world.
It's a great question. In 1988, when the rector was Jack Bishop, he came home from a vestry meeting after the vestry had voted yes, he could go on a sabbatical. And he said to his wife, Joanne, "We're going on sabbatical. Where would you like to go?" And one of the places she said she wanted to visit was Tanzania. And that is literally how it started. They went. The Diocese of Mount Kilimanjaro was a very young diocese, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and they established the relationship then. And here we are, how many years later, over 30 years later, still in relationship.
Wow. And then how did the relationship with the Ndupoto school or the founding take place? Because so you have a relationship going on for almost 15 years, which is pretty remarkable with a country in Africa and a diocese there. Then this school developed. What happened?
Well, first of all, my late husband and I heard a sermon at Christ Church Greenwich by Reverend Lee Walker, and he asked the congregation, "What are you doing with the gifts God has given you?" Flash forward, we're now missionaries to Tanzania, sent by Christ Church Greenwich. And we are teaching business, finance, and communication to a young bishop and his small staff. We lived there 3 years. And then, after my husband passed away, I would return and started leading church safaris. On one safari, our guard, our Maasai guard, his name is Toledo, said, "Mama, our kids aren't educated. The government has not built a school for us. Will you just come and look at some land where we want a school?" Well, we built one classroom. Thanks to a parishioner on my safari who gave us some starting money. And I called Karen by email and said, "Karen, I think I'm going to go see some land to build a school, but I'm only going to look." And the next email said, "Karen, you answer this."
There were 400 men, women, and children waiting for us. They had dug the foundation for a classroom. I guess we're building a school.
We built it in 1 month. 98 boys and girls showed up, and they could come at no matter what age they were. So that was the beginning.
And did you think that was kind of a one and done? We've built a one-room classroom. This is a nice little deed we were able to do. And now let's move on with our life.
Oh, of course we did. But those 98 children were really stuffed in one classroom. And the next safari that I led, some of my family members were there. And they said, "Well, why don't we build a second classroom?" Oh, okay. So on and on. And over the years, we've planted over, what, Karen, 500 trees? And we have a full campus, 10 classrooms, 751 Maasai boys and girls in the bush in a remote area of Tanzania are getting an education.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the Maasai because they're sort of a very interesting tribe. First of all, like, how are they doing? How have they changed in the last, 30 years? There's been so much change in the world. How are the Maasai reacting to change?
They used to be quite nomadic, and with roads being built and population growing, they've become farmers and staying where they are. They still have herds, and they still go far from home to graze their herds, but they're not picking up and moving the way they used to.
Every Maasai has a cell phone hanging around their neck.
Mm-hmm.
And in Tanzania, you can transfer money by your cell phone. Mm-hmm. It's called M-Pesa. And so this is helping with economics and their small businesses. So, and they've got motorbikes.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of getting on the back of a truck or a lorry and flagging it down and paying a little bit of money, some of them do have motorbikes, which they can load 3-4 people on. You'd be surprised. And a cart of Pepsi or eggs. It's amazing.
So you've seen a lot of transformation in the culture in the 30 years you've been going back and forth.
Yes. Oh, yes. In Arusha, we now have traffic lights, 5 of them. Doesn't mean that the motorcycles stop when it's, but the cars do. Tall buildings are going up. It's the safari capital of Tanzania. That's where the safaris start.
And how does the sort of Maasai culture persist, and how does it sort of interact with kind of now new Western culture? Like, do they still have Maasai warriors, for example? Does that still happen?
They're not allowed to kill a lion mm-hmm. anymore. That is a government law. And that was part of the tradition. They still have circumcision on the young 15-year-old guys. They do not have, I'm not sure, so I'm not going to answer that
question. That's a big, FGM is a big, female
yes.
genital mutilation is a big, has been a big issue over here, right?
It's illegal.
It's illegal.
It's illegal also.
But it persists probably. Yeah, at some level.
I don't ask.
Yes.
Or we don't ask.
There's one story of a young woman who, while we were there, her father took some action that you all addressed. Could you tell a little bit about that story about this young woman who was essentially going to have to leave school?
Yes, her name was Nema. That's Grace in English. And Nema, it was vacation time. It was December of last year, 2022. And she went home for vacation. And her father had sold her to an old Maasai man for a cow and into marriage. That's illegal in Tanzania. But it's still done. Anyway, she walked miles to get back to the school so she could tell the headmaster what had happened. Karen and I have learned from our many years there that we need to step back and let everything be handled by the elders. So although we were concerned, the elders took it into their hands, reported him to the police. There was lots of conversation. She's back in school. The cow's been returned. Everything's fine.
Yeah, and this was your first visit, Debbie, to Tanzania. Could you just tell us about that experience of what was it like to see this culture for the first time and then arriving at the school, which was kind of a breathtaking experience?
Yes, I have been teacher all of my professional life. So I was very curious and excited to see the school that I had heard so much about. But as we were in our Jeep and driving there, and we left Arusha, and it took about an hour to get to the school. And I looked out the window and I thought, how could there possibly be a school here? There was no road. There was really no anything. That no signs of human presence that I could see other than you know, Maasai walking with their cows. And sure enough, as we got very close to the school, they were expecting us. And they sent out a greeting party. This is a group of Maasai men and women in traditional dress, and they were singing and chanting and dancing there in the bush. And they met our car. We stopped and we got out, and they were so excited to see us and to show their joy. They were whooping and screaming and shouting and also jumping. There would, like, as if they were designated jumpers in the group. These were men, you know, sort of worthy of these Michael Jordan kinds of jumps. And they were so happy to have us there. And this was not at all what I had been expecting. I had come to Tanzania, and in my suitcase I had filled it with school supplies, which I knew they needed. I had paper and pens, and so I was just coming from this place of focusing on what they didn't have, on their lack. I had braced myself to feel quite sad that day at the conditions that they were in, and I was just dead wrong. I mean, they were just brimming over with joy. So that continued. We got closer to the school, and then I looked and I saw this sea of children, 700 plus children standing out in the sun waiting for us, waiting in these lines in front of their classrooms, and they're all clapping and singing. And I thought, my gosh, I'd never seen anything like it. At the end of that day, what I wrote in my journal, we had chances to go in the classrooms, and there it was just all of the joy and singing. It continued. At the end of that day, I wrote, this was like being fire hosed with joy, being in the presence of these children. And I thought, I couldn't even write anything after that. All I wrote was, I am changed. And I just left it blank after that.
And so did you get to sit into some of the classes and sort of see what they were learning?
I did. I was, one of the things that drew me to this trip was the opportunity to interact with Tanzanians. And as a teacher, I was very excited about the opportunity to go in the classroom and teach them a song. At the secondary level, I went in and led an arts and crafts project. So lots and lots of interaction with them. With the younger children, I went in with a couple of members of our group, including Merrick, and we decided to teach them "The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round." We chose this song because it's easy and has these great hand motions that go with it. So we got all their attention, which was very easy to do. I was astonished at their ability to focus and pay attention. Having taught in schools here, the phone and the distraction of social media has gotten to be such an issue with children's attention spans. And that is not at all what I was feeling. They were like a force field. And I thought, wow, this is an intact attention span and the power of it. So I sang the first line for the song, and we had queued it all up. They were going to repeat and imitate the motions. So I sang, "The wheels on the bus go round and round." And I stopped and gave them an opportunity to repeat it back. And they sang it right back. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them don't even speak English. And I was so floored by this. And I turned to our translator and I said, oh, someone's already been here and taught this song to them. And he said, no, they don't know it. They're just listening that well. Mm-hmm. And that I found astonishing.
Their attention span was like laser focus.
Exactly.
You go into an American classroom, it's like a group of ADHD, you know, just eyes and, you know, faces looking all around the place. They were just riveted. What else did you notice about the teaching? As someone who's taught at Greenwich High School for many years and devoted your vocation and career to education, what were some of the differences that you noticed?
I remember when I walked in, I had a backpack with me, and I had the various school supplies, and then I also had my water bottle, and I put those on the floor because I was getting ready to just stand up in front of the class and interact with the students. And I put it on the floor, and the teacher looked so alarmed, and she ran over. She literally ran across and picked up my backpack, and she picked it up and put it on her desk. And I had violated a code that you don't put important things on the floor, which they considered to be dirty. And over again, there were lessons like that, just about things and treating them with respect. I led this arts and crafts projects, and at the end there were a number of just scrap paper, and I had left a few sheets of paper there, and there was a small pair of child scissors, and I had moved on to another classroom, and then a group of school children came and they found me, and they said, you forgot these sheets of paper, these are yours, along with the scissors. And I said, oh, thank you very much. I gave no thought whatsoever to leaving that scrap paper there. And everything like that is very precious to them.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was mentioned earlier was that they didn't have any books, or that, you know, they only had like one or two books. And the books, I think, are not really part of the Maasai culture. Like, they had an oral history. And, you know, so that basically, you know, the idea of a book history and even literacy probably is relatively new. What is the sort of, I mean, are they reading? Are books part of the curriculum, or is it all mostly talking?
It's a government curriculum, and they're textbooks that the government approves and sends to the schools. The government doesn't have enough money to send enough textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
So we, Cheryl and I, have been lucky enough to have donors, and we work with a bookstore in Arusha, and we order more textbooks. So every bench, which might have three or four students on it in front of a desk, we hope every bench has a textbook, and every teacher has the guide to go with that textbook. I'm not criticizing the government. There just is not enough money. But there is a government curriculum. They made sure the public school is free to everyone other than buying the uniform.
How about the teacher-student ratio? It's absurd, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing when, you know, parents get all worked up if there are more than 20 children in a classroom with a teacher. What is it like over at the Ndapoto school?
That is a good question. Some of our classes have, like, first grade, second grade have over 100 kids, students. Our nursery, we now have a nursery school classroom that has over 100 students.
And we're talking about 100 students with one teacher, right?
Correct.
In one classroom.
In one classroom. And so they're thrilled when we bring over friends that do an art project or teach a song. These children, as Debbie was saying, have laser focus. They want to be there. They want an education. And their parents want their children educated. So there's not the disruption in a classroom. The teacher has all of their attention.
Are they all of different levels? So that's one of the things. If you're talking about 100 students, like, do they have to teach as different? You know, or do you have third, like it sort of was in the old, you know, in the old West, where you have, like, you know, the fourth graders are in the same class as the first graders. Is that the case, or no? They're all differentiated.
They're differentiated.
Uh-huh.
The kindergarten, there's a classroom next door that they can use sometimes, so they will divide the group. And I think that they, in part, divide it by skill.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the curriculum question, what they're learning in the first and second grade, they all are in the same classroom. By the third and fourth grade, they start doing subjects. And they study the same things that our students, you know, history, English is taught as a language starting in the fourth grade, science, math. It's not really, other than art isn't part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. They play sports at recess. Not on the same kind of fields our children play sports on, but
right.
They do play sports. I think Cheryl could speak to the sports.
Yeah.
Two times a week. Soccer for the boys and netball for the girls. That's it.
Netball is what? That's like a...
It's like a basketball.
Uh-huh.
We had a church in California... A part of our safari come out, and along with the elders, the Maasai elders, they cleared the brush and built the field. So,
and tell us about the infrastructure. You've built this out over the past 15 years. I think there are now 10 classrooms.
10 classrooms, yes.
And you've built quarters for teachers to live. There's a kitchen to prepare meals for the students, water storage tanks, latrines. What are the next steps that need to, you know, where there's kind of a crying hunger to say, we really need to do this to help the school move forward?
Do you want to address that, Karen? Because we're moving forward. With Indaputo, we're also now at the secondary school, but we have a neighborhood school down the dusty road
named Los Inyai. And with a very generous donation that we weren't expecting, we decided it was time to use our skills and see if we could help other primary schools in the district. And so in June, our project manager, Ephraim, visited Los Inyai and sent us pictures. They made me weep to see the disrepair that the school was in. It was built in 1975, and I'm not sure anything has ever been done to it since then. And so we were able to hire the contractor that we've worked with for 15 years to fix up the inside of the classrooms, new cement, new concrete floors that didn't have big holes in them, fix the outside, build a proper latrine for the teachers who live there, repair a water tank. So, and we want to visit other primary schools in the district and continue this part of our journey.
But what is needed, I think that was Merrick's question, is two more classrooms there.
Mm-hmm.
They are sitting under a tree, taking their lessons. It's been pretty, it was really run down. And they hadn't had any money for porridge for 2 years, nor water. So that, we've got the basics done. And now the headmaster's name is Mr. Safari, which we think is quite comical. He wrote recently and said, oh my gosh, the school is making headlines here in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
More and more kids are now signing up for school.
That's wonderful.
So the classrooms are bulging.
So you've now been doing this for a long time. Are you starting to see some like real results in terms of the students that have come through the system, and what have they gone on to do?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Do you want to answer that, Karen? Because I could go on and on.
We have helped students who come out of secondary school and do well enough on the government exam to be placed in colleges with their families. We've shared the expense of them doing that, and they're just starting to graduate. It's a 2 or 3 year course. We have 3 teachers who've graduated. And there'll be a young man who studied accountancy, that's what it's called there, graduating, and human resources. That's the next chapter. We're just finding out what's going to happen. But we have one star pupil, Kimbe.
Mm-hmm.
Kimbe is going to be a brain surgeon.
Okay.
But we just received a picture, and I don't think I told Debbie about this. We go to, on our safaris, we go to Ngorongoro Crater. And we received a picture of our graduate who is now taking lessons on how to become a ranger. And he was standing at the Ngorongoro gate with his full uniform on. But the best part about this story is his mama, is our cook at Indaputo. And he has been raised there since a little boy. And now he is going to be a ranger, and his mom makes a very little money, yet she has been supporting what she can to get him educated, along with us.
Debbie, I see you have a point you want to make.
Yeah, I want to come back to this this topic of school supplies. After I taught, Cheryl took me to the teacher's supply room, And she unlocked the door, and I walked in, and the shelves were quite empty. There were a few soccer balls in there, a xylophone, the books that were there, they were caked in dust, and they were quite dated. It really felt bare to me, particularly, of course, when I compare that to the supply closet at Greenwich High School, for example, which is just, we have everything that we need all the time. We recycle hundreds of books every year because we're just not using them all. But that being said, it's just amazing to me that how much they are accomplishing with the little that they have. So when I went to the secondary school, I had an art project ready, and I had prepared enough for 25 students. That was the number that I was told I would be working with. So I had enough for each student, a piece of paper. We were going to make cootie catchers, you know, the fortune tellers, so it's lots of folding sort of origami, and then you write. And so I was ready for the 25, and I walked into the classroom, and there were over 56 kids there. And I thought, how is this going to go now? Just rolled with it, because that's what you do in Africa. You just roll with it and see what happens. So the students were seated in groups. So I passed out a piece of paper so that each group had one piece of paper and each group had one marker. And I was so surprised when I handed them the paper and put the marker down. They just left it there. Nobody tried. In classrooms here, it would be not unusual to see students say, oh, you know, mine first, mine, I got it, you know, grab the marker, hey, you know, all of that. And they just left it there. And it was completely, as we moved through all the steps of making these, they shared with each other. It was completely seamless. I didn't say, okay, pass your pen to the next person. That just happened. So it's amazing what they accomplish, and it's beautiful to watch them do it.
I have to ask, because both of you are wearing some beautiful sort of jewelry from the Maasai, and of course they're really known for that, right? They have the extended earlobes, and they tend to be very adorned. But I would think in terms of teaching arts and crafts, these are probably pretty talented with being able to create things, or did you find that was the case, that
they were very excited about cootie catchers. They'd never made one of those. So.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, all the cultural translations. Ordinarily, if I had a group of children, I could say, oh, you could write something like, and this is literally what came to my mind, like, oh, you will have a good life, or you will be very wealthy. I was like, no, I'm not going to write that. And we ended up writing, we had all these sentences we wrote on the board to indicate good fortune. We wrote, you will have many cows.
That's great. So every year you all go back, and you've been doing this for like 3 decades, and every other year you bring a fairly significant size group over to see the school and to do a safari. I know Pat Beatty brought her daughter-in-law Michelle and her granddaughters Paige and Brooke with her. What's the experience like for both an individual and a family? And you've had other families come visit as part of this.
We always love it when families sign up and that we know children are going to be on the trip, because children, seeing that what we see through the eyes of a child, whether it's Paige, who's a high schooler, or Brooklyn, who's a middle schooler, or Davis many years ago, who was younger than that, opens up a whole different way of looking at things. I think it's a fabulous thing for a family to do together. For one thing, they're cut off from their screens and from all the stimulation that we have here, and they're together in the vehicle if you're on safari, or in the vehicle if you're going to the school, or in the classroom teaching something. So it's quite a wonderful experience. One year we had several teens, and they took one of the Land Rovers, or Toyotas actually, and made it the party vehicle, and they got in and they sang songs and interacted with each other. But every group is different. And if there aren't any children, we still have a great time. It's just that seeing it through children's eyes makes a big difference.
I agree with you. It is, it's remarkable watching the transformation of joy in these children and their parents. It's really remarkable.
You know, one of the things that we call this show The Calling, and one of the things we'd like to ask is, you know, is there a moment or was there where you kind of realized that this is sort of what you wanted to do and that this was something you were meant to do? And how did you sort of, you know, there are so many places where you can spend your time and your money and your effort. And what made this place so meaningful to you, that this is the place, you know, in the whole great big world, that you wanted to focus on this small place in Tanzania and really change that? How did you know?
Well, it did start with that sermon, "What are you doing with the gifts God has given you?" And the fact that my husband, Pete, and I lived there for 3 years, we were advised, don't do anything for a year. Listen, learn. And that has been invaluable. And I don't know if any of the listeners have been to Africa, but if you have, it does change your heart. Mm-hmm. And so I'll leave it at that. Karen?
I had gone to Kenya in 1983 and didn't think I'd ever be back to East Africa. I had had a great time going on safari. But then in 1995, my daughter, who was almost 9, and I went on a church trip. And I have to admit, we rolled through Arusha on a Saturday afternoon. I didn't realize that's when the stores were closed. Everything was beige. Everything looked boring. I thought, I've made a terrible mistake. I don't think I even want to get out of the van. But I'll have to act like I'm interested because I have my daughter with me. Well, fast forward. It's the relationships that mm-hmm. we built, first with the diocese, with the bishop, with the parishioners there, with building on what Cheryl and Pete had created in the 3 years that they were there. I was the beneficiary of. I stepped up in 1996 to help manage the relationship with the diocese because the person who'd been doing it couldn't do it anymore, and I just put my hand up there. I'd say the Holy Spirit led me to do this because it definitely was outside of my comfort zone. Like Debbie, I didn't have any idea what to expect. The next time I went over by myself on a plane. I have a funny story where I was carrying money in a money belt, a few $1,000s, and it was before we really started wiring money to do projects. And there'd been an ice storm in London, and I almost didn't get to go, and I went a different route through the Heathrow Airport. Somebody asked me, security, to open my money belt, and I did. And I guess I forgot to zip it closed. So I was going to Nairobi first and to visit a Greenwich young woman who was working there before I went on to Tanzania to see Cheryl. And I got up near the end of the flight to use the restroom, and I could feel money going down the inside of my pants. So I walked to the restroom sort of holding my knees, hoping that I wasn't leaving it behind me. And my overwhelming feeling was not distress. It was like, I don't have anybody to laugh with. This is so absurd. And then I waited, actually, till I got to Tanzania to count the money. And it was all there.
Yeah.
But I don't know what led me to that story, but it's just, I've just had amazing experiences, and it's the relationships that have kept me going.
Yeah.
Debbie, something really struck you during our visit. I mean, I could just see you coming alive and being transformed by everything you saw and experienced. It seems like this is perhaps a vocation after a vocation of teaching for you. What was going on, and where do you feel that's leading you now?
So I had taken a year off from classroom teaching. There were parts of teaching here that I loved, but I had some real frustrations. One of them was my office at the school had no window at all. When we wanted to know what it was doing outside, we'd have to check a weather app. And then my classroom as well, it had one small window, but I couldn't see out of it. And it doesn't, none of the windows in the school open. The school was built at a time when they were really trying to save energy. And so no windows open. And I started to feel just very, very hemmed in and frustrated that students were not able to be more present. So I had taken a year off. And yes, so I ended up on this beautiful trip to Tanzania. And I expected to witness the transformation that Christ Church and Karen and Cheryl were helping to create in the lives of the Tanzanians down there. But I would absolutely say that it became a transformative trip for me. We, as a group, began to live more like Tanzanians. We were outside all of the time, which I loved. And the landscapes there are absolutely glorious. And at night, you can hear this incredible birdsong, animals alive. Everything just feels so alive. We also lived in close community with each other. So we were together all the time in communal meals and supporting each other, laughing together. All of that, just there are all of these things that really just brought me so much energy and made me feel so alive.
Yeah, you know, Tanzania, I was kind of researching it for this, and it's sort of the, when you think about all the things you know about Africa, like a lot of it is in Tanzania, like Kilimanjaro is there, Lake Victoria is there, the Serengeti is there, it's where Livingston met Stanley, was there, it's everything that you sort of think about. I think it must be like a sort of a special place of all the places to go, right?
It's also where Jane Goodall.
Oh, right.
And yes, in
because she was in Uganda or
no,
she wasn't
in Tanzania
with the gorillas.
No,
I'm thinking of the wrong
with the chimpanzees.
Chimpanzees, okay,
right.
Got it.
Now how about Christianity? How I want to disclose as we kind of move towards our close to ask about how is it expressed differently there? What did you notice that was a different expression of our faith?
Well, I noticed immediately when we went to church that there is music and song and dancing. The choir will stand up and they're swaying side to side, and the energy is just electric in the church. They're really expressing joy with their bodies. They pray with their feet, if you will. And I found that to be so wonderful and so refreshing. It said about us Episcopalians that we're the frozen chosen, and that we go to church and experience it. You know, we think about religion. It's from the shoulders up. And this was quite the opposite. It's very, very energizing. And as we sat in the pews, the children would just move freely, young children, from woman to woman. Usually they had their own biological mother that they'd come with, but then they might go over to this woman, this other woman, who would then scoop them up. And so there is that feeling that you can, that anybody's really your mother. You have connection with women, and the women are your sisters, and the men are your brothers. So it felt like a family.
Also, prayer is present day and night. You don't get in a car with a Tanzanian without a prayer, mm-hmm. that you'll be safe, pretty much. And every meal is prayer, and it's prevalent everywhere. It's not just on Sunday.
Was it an Anglican diocese, and then it became Episcopalian, or how?
No, it's Anglican.
Anglican, yeah.
And it's growing rapidly. I think the bishop said he's established something like 400 churches in his tenure, which is mind-boggling. But Christianity is very fervent and alive there, which is beautiful to see.
Wonderful. Well, thank you guys so much for coming and talking to us. And what can people do to get involved with this project?
Give Merrick Zabriskie, our wonderful rector who went with us in January, send him an email, and he will help you get involved. And I would say thank you to both of you for hosting this. And it reminds me how thankful Tanzanians are all the time. Not only do they pray for a safe journey, but they give a prayer of thanksgiving when they arrive safely. So thank you for bringing us to a close.
When is your next trip over? Have you all made a decision yet?
Cheryl and I go in every January. We haven't decided yet when we're going to take a group.
Okay. Well, people.
I'm taking a small group this January, but it's closed.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to your next trip and having some folks who are listening right now perhaps join. And I want to thank all of you for being, you know, part of a miracle. It's something you can always look back and realize that what began through the grace of God is touching hundreds and hundreds of lives every year and will continue to do so. God bless you all. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Merrick.